Syria and Iran are accusing Israel of carrying out a series of airstrikes in Syrian territory over the past week. A former Israeli national security advisor tells us the strikes may be a warning to Iran and its proxies not to repeat a recent attack deep inside Israel.
And what you saw in the last few nights is a strong signal. Guys, if you change the rules, we change the rules as well.
Plus, we'll ask the Nuclear Threat Initiative about the prospects of Iran allowing UN inspectors to resume monitoring of sensitive nuclear activities. And later in the program, a new report suggests Russia is giving its ally Iran advanced digital surveillance capabilities. We'll analyze it with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
When there are Russian tools that everyone knows about, Iranian hackers can pick them up off the floor just like everybody else can.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Syria has accused Israel of pushing the region toward a major military escalation by carrying out a series of airstrikes on Syrian territory in the past week. Syria's foreign ministry also said Tuesday that Israel is committing external crimes to escape from internal problems, an allusion to recent mass protests in Israel for and against reforms of the Israeli judiciary. Israel did not claim responsibility for the strikes in Syria, which Israel's main regional enemy Iran said killed two of its personnel in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Tuesday that no internal debate will prevent Israel from defending itself. Yaakov Amidror is a former national security advisor to Netanyahu. I asked him on the phone what he thinks is behind the increase in apparent Israeli activity in Syria.
I think that the reason is that 2 weeks ago, someone infiltrated from Lebanon and put explosive on one of Israeli important junction in the north. It's probably 100 kilometers south of the border between Israel and Lebanon. Nothing was published about his identity, but my assessment is that was someone which made it on behalf of Hezbollah, probably an operative guy in Hezbollah. And in Israel, it was understood as an attempt to change the rules of the game. It's first time after many million years that someone infiltrating from Lebanon is acting within Israel. And I think that was kind of an attempt by Hezbollah to say, we are now acting differently than in the past. We feel more self-confidence in our abilities. And maybe they judge wrongly the state of Israel because of the domestic crisis that we are facing, you know, demonstrations and so on and so forth. They didn't understand the logic of democracy in which demonstration is part of the system and not destroying the system. And they thought that Israel will be paralyzed by the very strong measures which been taken by some of the demonstrators against the government, including saying that they will not serve in the reserve forces in the future if Israel will change the legal system in the way that think it's a huge mistake. And the security system is strong enough to understand what should be done, and the decision was to show Hezbollah, first, we can act, second, we can make decisions, and third, don't try to test us. And what you saw in the last few nights is a strong signal. Guys, if you change the rules, we change the rules as well.
Well, if Israel really was behind these latest strikes in Syria, and the Israeli government has not officially claimed responsibility for any of these strikes, why wouldn't Israel go after Hezbollah in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is actually based?
Because it is well understood in Israel that if Hezbollah will be pushed into the corner in Lebanon, that will lead immediately to a huge operation that Israel will win at the end. This is my assessment, but it is not the best time for Israel to begin such an operation. And we want to come to this operation that might come one day in a better position domestically and internationally. And this is why it was more convenient for us to show the Iranians and Hezbollah that, guys, if you are looking for weak points within the Israeli system, we know that you have weak points in your system, in this case, in Syria. But I will not be surprised if something will be done in Lebanon as well.
There was an apparent Iranian drone that infiltrated Israeli airspace on Sunday, and the Israeli military brought it down. What do you know about this drone?
What we know, it is exactly like the drones that the Iranians are selling to the Russians to kill people in Ukraine. We identified the version which was infiltrated to Israel, and it is very close to what the Russians are using after they bought it from Iran. And here the Iranians are taking something that is today used against civilians in Ukraine, and they try to do the same in Israel. But we were better prepared, and our capabilities probably are better than the Ukraine's, and we succeeded to neutralize it. But what we know about it, it's an Iranian version of what was sold by the Iranians to the Russians.
What do we know about how Israel brought down this Iranian drone?
Israel published the way that it was neutralized by electronic measures, what we call soft measures, not kinetic. And it is another facility or another tool that we have in our military system that we decide according to the situation, is to do it kinetically or by electronic measures.
The Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, said on Sunday that when necessary, Israel will push the Iranians out of Syria to where they belong, and that is Iran. How realistic would it be for Israel to actually do that?
I think that in the present condition, it's not realistic. But I think that it is the interest of the Middle East, in the interest of the Syrians, that the Iranians will not be in Syria, because the Syrians are paying very high price for the fact that they are allowing the Iranians to act from Syria, to build their facilities in Syria. So in the end, it's a decision that the Syrians will have to make, and maybe because then they will begin to understand how serious Israel is and what the price that they are paying for allowing the Iranians the freedom to act from Syria. They will do the job of telling the Iranians, please go home. Until then, it is not going to be easy for Israel to push the Iranians by itself outside of Syria.
Well, retired Israeli General Yaakov Amidror, former National Security Advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu and researcher for Jinzah Strategic Center in Washington, D.C., speaking to us on the line from Ra'anana in Israel. Thank you for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for this interview.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has started to implement a promise it made a month ago to allow UN inspectors to resume monitoring Iranian nuclear activities that could be weaponized. Iran has long denied seeking nuclear weapons. Speaking to U.S. Network PBS in an interview published April 1st, Rafael Grossi said it might take a few more weeks for Iran to implement the steps it agreed to in a joint statement with the IAEA on March 4th. So how does that compare with what Grossi said last month about what he expects from Iran? I put that question on the phone to nuclear security analyst Eric Brewer of the Nuclear Threat Initiative nonprofit group.
Well, I think it's important to look at that statement that came out at the time, right? There were two main elements of that joint statement. The first was about cooperation on what's kind of colloquially known as the safeguards probe, which is the IAEA's investigation into potentially undeclared materials and equipment that is in Iran that is likely part of Iran's previous nuclear weapons program that ended in 2003 and the attempts to clean it up. So the investigation into that effort is the first one. And then the second part of that joint statement is that Iran committed to allow further verification and monitoring activities. So on the first part of that commitment, the safeguards probe, we don't see any publicly available evidence that Iran has increased cooperation. And I should note, the term cooperation to suggest Iran has cooperated is quite generous. The IAEA has repeatedly said that it doesn't find Iran's explanations technically credible on these issues, and Iran has overall been dragging its feet quite a bit in providing this information and providing access. On the second part of that statement, the monitoring part of that, the picture is a little better, but it's still not clear, as I alluded to previously. Again, recall that Director General Grossi came out in early March following that trip where he met with the Iranian president, and he gave a very positive press conference, and he mentioned some specifics that were not contained in the joint statement about cameras being reinstalled and about online enrichment monitors being installed. And he kind of presented it as this done deal. Following that, some Iranian officials came out and sort of cast doubt on some of those claims. And since that time, Director General Grossi has been a little bit more measured in his comments and a little bit more careful. And so the latest interview, I think, is the most recent data point we have on this front that, again, suggests progress is underway, but it's quite slow, and it's not clear when all of these capabilities are going to be back up online. So there's still a lot of open questions about what exactly is going back into place.
If Iran does follow through on promises to, you know, have cameras reinstalled, to share footage from cameras that was denied to the IAEA in the past, how effective would that be in preventing Iran from making a breakout to a weapons-grade enrichment level?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that the IAEA and the access that inspectors have can only detect Iran's enrichment level and activities and provide some degree of warning. The IAEA can't prevent breakout. That is a task that falls on the international community. And detecting weapons-grade uranium enrichment quickly enough that something can be done to prevent it is a pretty tall order at this point, right? Iran can produce, according to estimates by U.S. officials, enough weapons-grade uranium for a bomb in less than 2 weeks. It took about 28 days from the time that the IAEA did the environmental sample that returned the results of 84% enriched uranium. From that time until the time that public reports emerged about that 84%, it was 28 days. And so, you know, you put those two timelines together, and it's not a very comforting picture. But it's certainly the case that increased monitoring would provide benefits.
Such as what?
For example, if Iran restored to roughly JCPOA-like levels of monitoring, the IAEA would have more frequent access, perhaps multiple times per week, to Iran's enrichment facilities, which would allow for faster detection of changes that would indicate potential weapons-grade uranium production. It would also provide for 24/7 monitoring by cameras that can plug gaps when inspectors are not physically present. It would also include the installation of online enrichment monitors and flow meters, which can monitor the level of enrichment in real time, and that would further enhance the international community's ability to detect any type of weapons-grade uranium production. I should also note that this monitoring, in addition to detecting a so-called breakout, it can also help ensure that nuclear material or technology is not diverted for covert purposes. And that's not an insignificant benefit, right? So it has benefits for both breakout and so-called sneakout. But again, even if you could detect breakout immediately, like let's say you could detect it as it's happening, you're still working with about a 2 week or less clock. And that's not a lot of time.
How likely is it that we might see the military option being used by the United States or Israel to stop an Iranian breakout?
Well, personally, I don't think we're going to see a military strike by either side out of the blue. I think for now, the most likely trigger for seriously considering the military option for either side is would probably be an attempt by Iran to produce 90% enriched uranium. In other words, weapons-grade uranium. And I think part of the reason why it's potentially a higher threshold is because both sides are aware of the risks and downsides of a military strike, right? A military strike at best disrupts and temporarily sets back the program. It can't bomb Iran's nuclear program out of existence. And following that strike, Iran would likely withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty if it hadn't already, and rebuild its program entirely covertly, away from international inspections, and likely increase its drive toward nuclear weapons. And then finally, of course, there would be a risk of significant military escalation in the region. So it is at best a delay tactic and one that comes with significant risks.
Well, Eric Brewer, Deputy Vice President at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. A March 27th report by the Wall Street Journal says Russia has been providing surveillance devices to its ally Iran over the past year to improve Tehran's cyber warfare capabilities. The article cited unnamed people familiar with the matter and did not name the manufacturers of the devices that the sources described. I wanted to find out what evidence there is of such Russian-Iranian cooperation, so I got on the phone with Annie Fixler, a researcher at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies nonprofit group.
It is a very difficult question to answer, and I think that's why there's quite a lot of generalizing in the article. What I will point to is there's some attributed and specific technologies that the piece talks about, and that is research out of Citizens Lab, which is a University of Toronto program. We do a lot of really interesting work about surveillance, human rights related issues. So we know of specific technologies, but we've got to either see the technology in the wild. So maybe identifying a phone that has been hacked and in some way you can see the software on it, or getting some documents, contract language between the technology provider and the purchaser. So I think that can get very difficult as to why we don't have the specificity. And I don't know this for a fact, but I mean, some of this may also be intelligence sources, right? It may be that the reporter has identified some of this based on some conversations with folks in the intelligence community. And that's why I think some of the information both is ambiguous still at this point, but also is on such a delay, right? The article speaks about how Russian and Iranian cooperation has improved since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, which we've all known about. There's all of the articles about Iranian drones and things like that. But specifically what makes this story interesting and problematic is because it's specifically around cyber cooperation. And so some of that takes some time to see in the wild, so which is why it's, you know, a year later that we're finally starting to see this articles about it.
Yeah. So it seems that Russia does have more advanced cyber warfare capabilities than Iran. Can you speak to how much more advanced Russia is, and how would Russia providing those tools to Iran kind of advance the Iranian capabilities?
Sure. Yeah. Russia, I mean, frankly speaking, is worlds above Iran in terms of its capabilities. Russia has pulled off very long-term operations. I mean, the starkest, most sophisticated recent operation was SolarWinds. SolarWinds was a technology software that was used ubiquitously across the U.S. government and in the private sector. And what Russia did over the course of 3 years at least was get into the software development environment so that they could basically latch their malware onto updates that the company was pushing out to its customers. So the company pushed out an update, the customers would update their software, and Russian malware would be embedded. And they did that over the course of years, and it went undetected for a very long time.
Has Iran been doing the same thing?
I have not seen reporting that Iran has been doing the same thing yet, but that's a big caveat, because what I've seen out of Iran is an attempt to copy the successful operations of others. So what we have seen is Iran compromise not always software, but other kinds of providers. So logistics companies or other service providers. Specifically in Israel, we've seen that, and as a way to then compromise the downstream clients of those companies. So it's not specifically the sophistication of getting into and hiding your malware within the software of a provider and not with the breadth that SolarWinds had, but certainly Iran has been trying to mirror and adopt the techniques that have been successful of others.
And have you seen any signs that Iran is using Russian tools to do this kind of work?
So there's a challenge when it comes to attributing the specific tools. So there are some things that as soon as it becomes public, as soon as we get announcement, you know, companies put out alerts and the US government might put out information, the FBI will publish alerts about malware and vulnerabilities, everyone's going to latch onto those. So when there are Russian tools that everyone knows about, Iranian hackers can pick them up off the floor just like everybody else can. The concerning piece and what will be very concerning to watch for is whether Russia is providing training or access to Iran. That will be very damaging because the strategies behind the use of tools, how Russia is dividing up its hackers, you know, who focuses on developing access and compromising devices versus who develops malware that actually degrade those devices, who focuses on developing human insider sources, and the sophistication behind that from the Russian side. If we see that start to mirror on the Iranian side, they will become a much more dangerous actor.
So when it comes to the dangers and threats from Iranian cyber warfare actors, who are the most vulnerable targets of those attackers? Are they people inside Iran or outside Iran or both?
The short answer is both. The focus of Iran's cyber program are the enemies of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the enemies of the regime specifically. So it's anyone, individual, country, company that the supreme leader determines are his enemies. So that is a lot of Iranian citizens, whether they live in Iran or abroad, they are a threat to the regime. And so they are a significant target of Iranian cyber activity.
So what should the U.S. and its partners do in response to Iran, you know, improving its cyber warfare capabilities with Russian help?
Right. So what the United States should do depends on sort of do with whom, to whom, and how. So a key thing that the United States companies, government, individuals need to do is strengthen defenses, right? You need to deny the adversary the ability to cause harm. So the U.S. government specifically needs to help companies provide them information or possibly training or tools that they can use to defend themselves, to defend against attacks. For citizens, that more relies on education around some simple things that individuals can do: strong passwords, multi-factor authentication, don't click malicious links. Like, that will take care of most stuff for individuals. That's not the same when it comes to individuals who might be under specific threat. That's a different category of folks who may need heightened levels of security. But the U.S. government also has a unique role because they can punish adversaries. We do not give individuals and individual companies the ability to punish those who attack them. That is uniquely an ability of the United States government and working with its partners and allies.
When you say punish, does punish mean go on the offense?
It absolutely can mean that. Specifically in the cyber realm, it could mean going into Iranian network infrastructure and actually disabling infrastructure. Publicly, we've seen cases where the FBI and Justice Department have announced that they have done that against ransomware actors, working with partners and allies around the world. But you don't always need to combat cyber with cyber. The U.S. government has vast economic tools, military tools, if it chose to use them. That would be a crossing a specific threshold if we responded in that way. But there are other tools, diplomatic tools, there are other options.
All right. Well, Annie Fixler, director of FDD's Center on Cyber and Technology Innovation, joining us from Houston, Texas. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's a wrap of our program. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Good to have you with us, and I hope you'll come back next week for another Flashpoint Iran.